Welcome to Westminster tonight. It's great to see all of you here. My name is Larry Hayward. I'm the one of the pastors here, senior pastor, and we are terrific to offer this opportunity to the community and to this congregation. Naturally, I have the honor of giving you all of the logistical details that are involved in a gathering like this. This is our third annual dessert and dialogue, and we are pleased with each of them and particularly with our guests tonight. I would invite everyone to silence their cell phones at this moment. We'll give you a moment of silence to do that. We do ask that you not take photographs during the program. We have a member of our church who is taking photographs. The lecture or this exchange and the photographs will be on our webpage probably within a day or two, and we would invite all of you to enjoy that. Restrooms are down this hall to the right. That includes an accessible restroom and a ramp if you need to go off a little bit to the left to get to that. At the conclusion, one of our associate pastors, Casey Fitzgerald, will lead a prayer. We do ask everyone to remain seated until our guests depart, and then everyone may disperse to their cars. Are there cards that people can fill out now?
I've got some.
They're in the pews, yes. If you have questions, you may fill cards out in the pews, and there will be volunteers who can take those for you that can then be read to the guests. If you need to leave during this program, we just remind you, if you leave through these narthex doors, they are locked, so you will not be able to get back in through these doors. You would need to enter through the parking lot doors to my left. And finally, I just want to thank... I'm sorry. It's probably just me not being close enough. I'm sorry. I don't usually use this mic, and I really haven't said anything important yet, so I won't repeat it. Thank you, Barb. I do want to thank Congressman Fred Upton and Congressman John Lewis for being here. I don't know how long Fred and Amy have been at Westminster, but it has been as long as you have been in Congress, so since the 1980s. And they are both terrific members and very active people here. I've had the privilege of knowing John Lewis from a distance from the Faith and Politics Board, and as all of us here appreciate your life and work and witness and are honored by your presence. Charlie Cook also has many friends at Westminster. We appreciate your being here and most of all using your skills moderating, and appreciate your wife Lucy being here as well. I want to thank our Adult Ed Committee, chaired by Kristen Bishop, and all of its helpers and volunteers. And I do want to thank Amy Upton. Amy is sometimes known as the aunt of a model. She is sometimes known as the spouse of a member of Congress. But here we know her as a terrific long-term member and elder in this congregation. And for the last 3 years, she has been on our staff as director of adult education. And she is the genius and driving force behind this, and I don't see her, but I do want to thank her. Okay, she's crawling under the pew. So with that, let us pray. God of all nations, you have called particular people to serve in elected office in this nation at all times in its history. And you have called two of those persons, John Lewis and Fred Upton, for this time. Guide them in their work as they seek to serve and lead our nation in its work. And continue to grant us the freedom of assembly, the freedom of religion, the freedom of the press, all of which are present and evident in this holy and public sanctuary tonight. In your name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Hi, I'm Charlie Cook, and I have the honor of moderating tonight. I came in and I looked around. I thought, I've been here before, and I couldn't remember why. And turned out Lucy and I were here for Whit Ayers and Angela's wedding here. And and the fact that this church has two pollsters in it suggests that it's not like many other pollsters in the country, Whit Ayers and Christine Matthews. But anyway, thank you for having us here. I suspect I'm not the only person here that thinks that, well, American politics in Washington and American society has seen better days. But I think it's while we should never ignore what's wrong with the system, we ought to look at what's right. And who's right? And who are the really, really good people, the people that we want more like that to come into politics? And tonight we have just two of those people. Lucy and I were at something recently, and I heard a line that I thought was incredibly inspiring. Lifting as we climb, onward and upward. And these were the words of Mary Church Terrell, who was the founder of the National African American Women's Organization. She was born in 1863, the same year the Emancipation Proclamation was written, and she died in 2 months after the historic Brown versus Board of Education that ruled that segregation of public schools was illegal. But lifting as we climb onward and upward, that could be the motto for John Lewis, who's going to speak first. And I learned just preparing for this that John Lewis was born and raised in Pike County, Alabama, which you may not know was also the home of Hank Williams Jr. and Kid Rock. Just if you were curious. Growing up on a farm, the son of sharecroppers, as a boy, John would gather his young brothers, sisters, cousins, and the chickens to hear him practice giving sermons. I just think that's awesome. Inspired by the Montgomery bus boycott, as well as the words of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., John decided early on to become part of the civil rights movement. And while he was a student at Fisk University in Nashville, he began organizing sit-in demonstrations at segregated lunch counters. At the age of 21, John was participating in the Freedom Rides and at age 23 was the national chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and one of the six major leaders of the civil rights movement and helped organize the March on Washington. John both talked the talk and walked the walk of nonviolence despite over 40 arrests, physical attacks, and serious injury. Leading with Hosea Williams, the now famous March of 600 from Selma to Montgomery in 1965, John and others were mercilessly clubbed by police officers while crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge in what became one of the seminal moments of the civil rights movement. Along the way, John earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in Religion and Philosophy from Fisk and graduated from the American Baptist Theological Seminary as well, and has since been the recipient of honorary degrees from over 50 major universities in the country, including Columbia, Duke, Harvard, Howard, Princeton, and Morehouse. After serving on the Atlanta City Council, John was elected to Congress in 1986 and is now considered really one of the most principled, what it is, people have called him the conscience of the U.S. House of Representatives. And one thing that I think was kind of interesting is when, as a young man, John saw how a comic book, Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Story, about the 1960 lunch counter sit-ins, told the story to young people who may not have learned it another way. And since then, to share his own experiences with young people, John has authored with two others a trilogy of graphic novels entitled March, aimed at kids, telling his story and the behind-the-scenes story of the civil rights movement, what happened and what it meant. So as I said, as Roll Call once wrote, that John Lewis is a genuine American hero and a moral leader who commands widespread respect within the institution. So why don't we let Congressman Lewis go first, and then I'll introduce Fred after you're finished. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Charlie, for those kind words of introduction. I must say that you just told everything about me, so, but I appreciate it. I'm delighted, very pleased, and honored to be here in this historic church. To be here with my friend and colleague, we've both been in Congress now for 30 years. We came to Congress together in the same class. And Fred, Amy, thank you. You're wonderful friends. Fred, you are like a brother. I remember visiting your district many years ago. And I would never forget that visit. Now, you heard in the introduction that I did grow up in rural Alabama, 50 miles from Montgomery, outside of a little place called Troy. It is true that my father was a sharecropper, a tenant farmer. But back in 1944, when I was 4 years old, and I do remember when I was four, I really do, my father had saved $300 and a man sold him 110 acres of land. We still own this land today. I grew up with 6 brothers and 3 sisters, wonderful mother and father, grandparents and great-grandparents. And sometimes when we would visit the little town of Troy, visit Tuskegee, or visit Montgomery, I would see those signs that said, white men, colored men, white women, white waiting, colored waiting. And I would come home and ask my mother, why? She would say, that's the way it is, boy. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But I went to Sunday school every Sunday. I attended church on the first Sunday, the third Sunday, a Methodist church one Sunday, a Baptist church the next Sunday. And I felt as a little child that segregation was not in keeping with the teaching of the great teacher. And I learned to read the Bible as a child. As a matter of fact, one of my uncles had Santa Claus to bring me a Bible when I was very young. And it's true. Charlie, I did want to preach. And we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard. And I would talk to these chickens. And on one occasion, I tried to baptize one, and it just didn't work. But those chickens taught me patience. They really did. When you set the setting hen must set for 3 weeks. But from time to time, I would cheat on these setting hens. When the little chick would hatch, I would take these little chicks and give them to another hen. And get some more fresh eggs, mark them with a pencil, place them under the setting hen, and wait for 3 long weeks for the little chicks to hatch. I was never quite able to save $18.98 to order the most inexpensive incubator, a hatcher from the Sizzle Roebuck store. Any old enough to remember the Sizzle Roebuck catalog? You don't. You're not that old. That big, heavy, thick book. Some people call it the wish book. I wish I had this. I wish I had that. So I just kept on wishing. And sometimes when we would have a meal with chicken, I would boycott the meal. Because my mother and father dared to have a chicken that I had raised for meal. But growing up there, I would be working in the field sometime, picking cotton, gathering peanuts, pulling corn, and I would fall behind, and my mother would say, boy, you need to catch up. You need to catch up. And I would say, this is hard work. And she said, well, sir, hard work never killed anybody. I said, well, it's about to kill me. So in 1955, 15 years old in the 10th grade, I was bused long distances over unpaved road to attend segregated school. And I asked my mother, and my mother, my father, and my grandparents, why? Why this? Why that? And my mother would say, boy, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But I heard Martin Luther King Jr. on the old radio preaching a sermon. He called it Paul's Letter to the American Christians. And that sermon inspired me. And I said, well, if Dr. King can preach a sermon like this, can be the leader of the bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, as a minister, then I too can do something. I can make a contribution. So as a little boy, with my brothers and sisters and some cousins, we went down to the public library in the little town of Troy to get library card, to check out some books. We were told by the librarian that the library was for whites only and not for colors. I never went back to that library until July 5th, 1998 for a book signing for my first book, Walking with the Wind. And hundreds of blacks and white citizens showed up. We had a wonderful signing, spoke about growing up there. Even the family that has sold us the land came. And at the end of the program, end of the little reception, they gave me a library card. It says something about the distance we've come and the progress we've made in laying down the burden of race. Now, Rosa Parks and Dr. King had a great influence on me. Rosa Parks grew up in a Methodist church, and Dr. King in a Baptist church. And to meet these two individuals have changed my life. To go to church every Sunday, hear the minister deliver the message, to go to Sunday school, it forced me, in a sense, to look at the big world. Not just the world of rural Packhannock, Alabama, but I came to the conclusion that we all were one family, that we all live in the same house. Not just American house, but the world house. And I remember something A. Philip Randolph said, Charlie, when we were planning the March on Washington. He said, maybe our foremothers and our forefathers all came to this great land in different ships. We're all in the same boat now. That it doesn't matter whether we're black or white, Latino, Asian American, or Native American. We're one people. We're one family. And then as I got to know Dr. King, I listened to this man. He inspired me to stand up, to speak up, and to speak out. When I was growing up, I grew up very shy. The chickens became my friends. I could preach to them. I can talk to them. I tried to protect them. Tried to keep them from making it to the dinner table. But Dr. King was said from time to time, and let me just deviate for a moment. I wanted to attend a little college 10 miles from my home called Troy State College, now known as Troy University. Submitted my application, my high school transcript. I never heard a word from the college. So I was accepted at a little school in Nashville, Tennessee called American Baptist Theological Seminary, today called American Baptist College. An uncle of mine gave me a $100 bill, more money than I ever had, gave me a footlocker to put my few books, my clothing, everything that I own except those chickens in that footlocker. And took a Greyhound bus to Nashville, Tennessee. And after being in Nashville for about 3 weeks, I told one of my teachers that I'd been in contact with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King got back in church with me, because he heard from one of my teachers that I was there, and suggested when I was home for spring break to come and see him. So on a Saturday morning in March of 1958, I boarded a Greyhound bus, traveled 50 miles from Troy to Montgomery. And a young lawyer, who also was a young minister by the name of Fred Gray, met me at the Greyhound bus station in Montgomery and drove me to the First Baptist Church, pastored by the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, and ushered me into the pastor's study. I saw Dr. King and Reverend Abernathy standing behind the desk. And Dr. King said, "Are you John Lewis? Are you the boy from Troy?" I said, "Dr. King, I am John Robert Lewis." I gave my whole name, but he still called me the boy from Troy. But I heard him say over and over again that we must learn to live together as brothers and sisters. If not, we will perish as fools. And then we heard the Pope say, when he spoke to a joint session of the Congress, he said, "We all are immigrants. We all come from some other place." So it instilled in me that we must be a little more human as children of the Almighty. And we believe that there is a spark of the divine in all of us. He cannot destroy. We must respect that spark of divinity and be a little more human. Live to love and live to grow in God's grace. Thank you very much.
My longtime friend Fred Upton represents, in my view, the very best of the Republican Party, the part of the Republican Party that was the party of Abraham Lincoln. After graduating from the University of Michigan, Fred came to Washington and worked on the staff for 4 years of Congressman David Stockman. And then when President Reagan named Stockman to be the OMB director, director of the Office of Management and Budget, Fred went with Stockman to the OMB and worked there for another 4 years. And then in 1986, at the age of 33, Fred ran against and beat in a Republican primary the incumbent congressman who came from, shall we say, the non-Abraham Lincoln wing of the Republican Party. And I should add that Fred is much too nice a person to say this, but that congressman later pled guilty and sentenced to a year and a day in prison. So no matter what Fred did as a congressman, it was going to be a step up. But I can only say that because I'm a friend. Fred became a sponge when he came to Congress and listened and watched and learned and gradually became one of the most effective members of Congress and became ultimately the chairman of the House. Actually, I think powerful is part of the title of the Energy and Commerce Committee. And during the 6 years up until this past December, was six of the most productive years the Energy and Commerce Committee ever had. And they did all kinds of amazing landmark pieces of legislation: energy and pipeline safety, mental health, chemical safety, safe drinking water, rural broadband. But to me, the one piece of the legislation that meant more than anything else was an idea that Fred had and that he nurtured, and along with a Democratic congresswoman, Diana DeGette, pushed through the 21st Century Cures Act. And it was signed into law by President Obama in December of 2016, aimed at helping the National Institutes of Health and the Food and Drug Administration find and expedite development of cures for deadly and debilitating diseases. As Fred pointed out during that time, while he was pushing it, there are over 10,000 diseases, and roughly 7,000 of them are rare, but there are only 500 real cures for those 10,000 diseases. In just a few years, there are going to be millions of Americans, millions of people probably around the world, that will benefit from the 21st Century Cures Act, an idea that Fred had, and against some sometimes pretty tough odds, pushed through Congress, and just a great example of the kind of bipartisanship that we used to see a lot of. We don't see nearly as much anymore. And just as a personal note, in an occupation and an institution not known for humility, I can tell you that Fred is the most humble and least affected powerful member of Congress that I've ever met. And though almost 64 years old, 7 months older than I am, Fred always exhibits this youthful exuberance and contagious enthusiasm, and through good times and bad, and it's been sorely tested in recent months with the Chicago Cubs and the University of Michigan. But both of these men represent the ideals of public service in a way that has become all too rare. And I think both of them represent, what I like to tell people is, vote for people you agree with, vote for people who share your values, but always keep this in mind. Vote for someone who you believe will sit down and talk with someone from a different point of view, from a different party, And because the democratic process works on consensus, and the legislative process works on compromise. And these are the kind of values of public service that both of these men represent. And so it's a real honor for me to moderate this session. So now, there are more cards that are being collected, right? But I've got a handful. Let me just, actually, I'm going to kick off with the point of personal privilege, one question. And then while I figure out, go through these others. Excuse me? Oh! Yes. Fred, did you want to speak?
You know, you got it. You know, hey, we just had votes tonight. You know, you got to ask the speaker. You know, to yield time. So
I yield to the gentleman.
Well, it is a delight to be here, and I sort of thought that I would try to think of one thing that you wouldn't find in my resume, and I did come up with one, and that was that from my background, my great-great grandfather was actually a missionary to the Zulus in southern Africa. And I read his book. He wrote a book in the middle 1840s, 50s. And it took him 10 years to get his first Christian convert. So he was really an incredible guy. But I look at my family, public service, a couple of uncles that were in public service. And I'll have to confess that I never thought that I was going to be running for the U.S. Congress, particularly when I had never run for any other office before. And we had, John and I were the same class, as he mentioned, and we had quite the august group of folks, freshmen, that were coming in. Two former speakers, Pelosi and Hastert. We had a guy that was Fred Grandy, who everybody knew from Love Boat. We had little athletics, Jim Bunning, a Cy Young Award winning pitcher for the Tigers and the Phillies. We had Amo Houghton, the first Fortune 100 CEO ever elected to the Congress. And we had John Lewis, a hero in everybody's book. Everybody, if we lived in his district, we would all be voting for this guy. We'd all be putting up his yard signs. And we all listen intently to so many things that he says that are right on in terms of where we want to be as a country. And I'm part of that group of, I guess it was 45 or 50 Democrats, equally divided. And I can remember going to my the leadership before we were sworn in, and they had one big message. We're Republicans. We've been in the minority for, Fred, your lifetime. No one thought that it was going to change. And if you want to get things done, or if you got a couple different options, you're always going to be on the losing side. Your idea is either going to be stolen or defeated, so just get used to it. And I said, you know what? That's not going to happen to me. There's not going to be an issue here that I work on that isn't bipartisan. So one of the guys that was in our class was actually Amy's mother's congressman. She was from Baltimore. Great guy by the name of Kwaisi Mfume. I was probably the only guy that could say it, spell it, and good guy, and he later became head of the NAACP. And I went to Kwaisi, and I said, Kwaisi, I got this idea to help those that are disabled. The Americans with Disabilities Act is moving forward. President Bush, 41, is going to sign it into law. And I know that these small businesses don't want to discriminate against anyone that's got some type of disability, but they can't help it because they don't have the funds. They don't have the funds to put the steps in or change the bathrooms or do all those different things. So let's do a tax credit. And he said, well, it's your idea. You do it. So the Upton Mfume bill, and we got the Black Caucus. And at the end of the day, it became law and was hailed as the most important piece of legislation that impacted small businesses in that Congress. And John was one that voted for it as well. It was unanimous. And I look at, you know, some of the things that Charlie cited, particularly 21st century cures. How did that start? Well, I had two little girls come into my office, and John and I see all of our constituents when they come by, whether it be in our district or here in D.C., and I had two little girls come to my Kalamazoo office, and they have just a crippling disease. It's fatal, usually by the time you're 13 or 14 or 15. It's SMA, it's a spinal disease, and these two little girls, they I asked what their names were, and they said, well, this is my sister Cinderella, and I'm Sleeping Beauty, and they had little crowns on, and they're in these little wheelchairs, and they just, you know, it just breaks your heart knowing, you know, without a cure, what's going to happen. So we started that effort. In fact, actually, when I found John tonight on the floor to make sure, you know, everything was fine coming here tonight, he was sitting with Diana to get on the house floor, who's my was the Upton to get bill. She's on our committee, deputy whip for the Dems. And Amy doesn't know this, but we're speaking at a breakfast tomorrow with Dr. Collins at 7 downtown. This is how I can get her to nod to say, "Oh, you're going out that early." Yeah. But you know, we worked. What we did was we listened. I mean, it's sort of like John and I and you know our colleagues. You need to listen to people to find out what their concerns are. How can you help them? That's what our job is. You know, most people contact their member of Congress maybe once in a lifetime. And so whether it's a Social Security issue or a veterans issue or just a problem, you want to try and we're fixers. We're trying to fix it. And so that's what this bill did. We did something that Congress is often accused of never doing, that listening to you name the group, disease groups, cancer, ALS, SMA, that's spinal disease. Our researchers, our universities, whether it be Michigan or Penn State, that killed us this last weekend, I'll go to. You know, the industry, and frankly, the NIH and the FDA, we're asking them to do more. So what is it that how can we help you to approve these drugs and devices faster so that they don't go overseas and you take the jobs and everything else? And at the end of the day, President Obama signed it into law with a great ceremony down at the White House, 392 to 26. Believe me, I know who those 26 are. It's one from Michigan. But it was, you know, Mitch McConnell said that it was the most important thing that Congress did last year was to pass this bill. But it was bipartisan, and it really did something. And I go back to my early days with John. He grabbed me in the well of the House early in, it must have been my second or third year in the Congress, and he said, "Fred, have you ever been to Alabama?" And you know, I never had been. I grew up in Michigan, you know. He said, "Well, I'm leading this march in Selma, and I'd like you to go with me." So we were in this group together called Faith in Politics, and bipartisan. I had a little prayer discussion group. Larry's been part of that. First couple years in office, I participated. So John said, "Fred, I'd like you to go with me." And I said, "When is it?" He said, "Well, it's the first weekend in March." I said, "I'm there. I don't know what I'm doing that weekend in Michigan, but I'm going with you. My staff's not here to say no, so I said, I'm going with you." And actually, Amy and I went down a number of times. And one year, I actually was the co-chair with John. But this was really something else. And I would really urge all of you at some point to do that. Selma was a little other story that Charlie didn't find out, but I had a relative that was a commandant at West Point, and he was in Custer's class. And he has a statue on Little Round Top at Gettysburg. And he charged successfully through through Lee's lines at Fredericksburg. And he actually liberated Selma, as I read more stories about him. But going with John Lewis to Selma and being in his church and walking across arm in arm with, I got to say, maybe certainly thousands, if not more than 10,000 people, was really something else. And to ride with Fred Shuttlesworth and other civil rights icons as we spent a couple days going from Birmingham to Selma to Montgomery, seeing that little church where those little girls were killed just breaks your heart. But yeah, I really got to experience that firsthand with a leader, someone like John. And we bonded. We were close anyway because we're the same class and had so much respect for him. And later, I think we had some civil rights issues or civil disturbance in my home community. And it was bad. It was bad. And so I talked to the governor, and she had actually never been to my home community. She was new, And she said, Fred, I know you got a pretty good handle on it. What do you think we ought to do so that this violence doesn't erupt and grow, sort of like we've seen it happen in other communities even recently? And I said, well, you know what? I'm going to ask my friend John Lewis for advice. So I went to John, and he said, Fred, in that great voice of his, I want to help. I'll go. So he came literally the next weekend to my community. And we met with, he spoke at the community college. It was standing room only. I mean, this huge room. I mean, it must have been 800 people there. We had some private meetings with the ministerial group. And John gave great advice to them in terms of how we could calm this issue. But we also knew we had to work long term. We had to look at what caused this death of an unfortunate guy. And so we worked on education. We worked on jobs. We worked on real hope for people that live in our community to do better. And looking back, and John's not been back yet, but he probably would come if I asked him, but it's okay. But it is, we've turned the corner. We've got great economic development. We've got jobs. We've got an increased tax base. And we did little things like invite an African-American or other, the other race to your house for dinner. Let's put up some support groups and communicate with each other so you really don't have two sides of the story. You have just one side where we're working together. And as John said, he's that same story. We're all in the same boat. We are. We want these communities to go. So, I look at that relationship that John and I established, and going back to my days is, always working on a bipartisan basis to make not only the Congress a better place, but frankly, the communities that we represent as well. So I thank you, John, for that, for your work, and for being here with me tonight. And Charlie, my good friend as well, and fellow Wolverine. I don't know where you went to. Franklin and Marshall, is that called?
Georgetown.
Right? Georgetown, right. But they don't have a football team there, so he roots for my Wolverines. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Fred. I've got seven or eight questions here, but I just wanted to throw one out just to get the ball rolling. When I was a kid, there used to be cartoons, and everybody here, same age generally, there was a cartoon, and there are many cartoons, where you would have an angel perched on one shoulder and the devil perched on another shoulder. And the angel would be whispering to do the right thing, and the devil would be tempting you to go the other way. Now, things generally in life aren't quite that clear-cut. But when you're faced with a legislative or political question, and there's a principled way that may not be terribly practical or plausible, and then there's the easier way that probably is the more practical, but isn't going to make you feel a whole lot better about yourself. How do you wrestle with these tough questions? How do you, what process do you work through to get to where you end up going? I'll start off with Congressman Lewis.
Well, Charlie, sometime I have what I call an executive session with myself. But I won't talk back to myself, because you make a mistake when you start talking back to yourself. But sometimes I just say, Seth, really, do what is right. Do what is fair. And sometimes you have to go with your inner self, with your gut. And maybe it's not going to help you back home in your district, but it's the right thing to do. So I just try to do what I think is right. I talked to my colleague, and you come together. You know there's old saying, let your conscience be your guide. You have to live with yourself.
I have to live with my wife.
Sometimes I even said, what would Jesus do? If he had a vote, how would he vote?
Well, I have a little plaque on my desk. My desk, you know, it's a working desk, let me tell you. But there's a little bronze plaque with, you don't have to put it on your reading glasses to see it, but it was on my grandfather's desk, and it says, do the right thing. So it's really along the same lines. But, you know, there's a rule in the Congress that's got to be on the House floor to vote. You can't vote for here. If we had a vote right now, we'd both miss it. You all right? And I'll tell you, it's that relationship that you have with on both sides of that where you can talk to people and really get a decent understanding of what it might be. And you can bounce things off. And you know, people they're respected. You're almost more respected when you cross that party line, and which I'm not afraid to do, because that shows that you stood up to folks and you did vote your conscience.
The first question from the congregation, we'll go with Congressman Lewis on this one. How can people of faith be most effective in fighting to protect civil and human rights battles of today?
When people of faith see something that is not right, not fair, not just, say something. Do something. And try to bring others in. I think somehow, some way, we become too quiet. When I'm speaking sometime, or preaching a sermon to some of the people back home and to some of my colleagues, I would say we must be headlights and not taillights. Wow. That we must lead. If you feel something in my tradition, religious tradition, if you feel something, you should be able to show some sign. When I first moved to Atlanta in 1963 at the age of 23, I became a member of Dr. King's Father Church. We call him Daddy King, Ebenezer Baptist Church. And sometime young Martin Luther King Jr. would be preaching. And Daddy King was there to his son, make it plain, make it plain, make it clear. I think people of faith must make it plain, must make it clear and show the way.
Okay, for Fred, the next one is, what constructive actions can we take at the grassroots level to push back against the new tribalism and nativism that is growing in this country right now?
Well, you know, I was a journalism major, and it's, you know, the world is so different in terms of news and how fast it goes. You got so many different, you know, 24/7 news outlets, but you've got the social media that is there that's instantaneous, and you've also got the pushback. No matter what you say, there's 100 people that are going to go criticize you, which is a little bit of the unfortunateness of that social media. But you know, you got to use it. You got to speak out quick. I know when Charlottesville happened, Amy and I were actually overseas. We were on a bipartisan trip, and, you know, a big time difference. And, you know, we know Charlottesville. Amy's sister lives there. Been down there a lot. My son played lacrosse down there. Been down, you know, weddings. All of, and, you know, I saw what happened, and I got to my, you know, the internet worked. Sent out a quick little statement, got refined, of course, by my crew, and it was out the door, and I felt good about what I said, about that awful events. And, you know, we flew to the next stop on the way home, and all of a sudden there was another eruption there. It was like the staff, well, you got to say something else. I said, I already put out a statement, and, you know, I'd been missed the 5 hours in between on the airplane. And we did another statement that was even more harsh than criticizing what went on. And I just think that, you know, as you see these different events, people do expect leaders to act quickly. and to fill that void. And as John said so many times, you know, get in the way. Stand in the way of hatred and bigotry wherever it might come. And we do. I'm proud of, you know, what I said on those, you know, on a variety of different things. But I think that our, you know, today people expect us to almost have a comment almost with everything that happens. And it's difficult to do, but we try to react as quickly as we can on that.
The next question, there are several that are very similar, but this is one that stood out as different from all the others. Someone asked, my relatives are posting some surprising political comments on Facebook that I disagree with. How do you suggest I discuss politics with them at Thanksgiving? Now, my suggestion is don't invite them. Anybody?
Well, you cannot give up on your relatives, you know. You cannot, you know, disown them. Just talk with them. You can never, ever give up on someone. You know, during the early days of the movement, we studied the way of peace, the way of love, the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. And you try to see this spark of goodness and just try to bring it out. People, your brothers and your sisters, your uncles and I, work with them. You know,
I was going to say, you don't know my sister, but anyway.
Look, just don't give up. Keep trying.
Brad, do you have any suggestions?
You know, I know that relative story. Amy, you didn't send that card up, did you? I got some relatives that are pretty tough, let me tell you. But they're not voters for me. I know that. It's hard. You know, it is, you know, as John and I are so immersed in all the details of virtually every bill that goes, not, you know, yeah, you got to reach out. But it is unfortunate, some of the stuff that comes out with outside Facebook. That's where, man, I did something on the Great Lakes. Great Lakes, sort of, don't mess with Texas, don't mess with the Great Lakes. And we did a big bill that helped the Great Lakes, and I still got negatives on that from folks. So, you know, John, a lot, you know, because of his background, a lot thicker skin than I do, but, you know, it still hurts. I mean, some of this stuff that comes out, but it is hard. We all have relatives that are not always real happy, and I don't know the best thing. We got this little whiskey sour mix, and maybe I would give them a double. Put them to bed, you know, after the walk on Thanksgiving.
What happened in Virginia, it made me cry. I really cried 2 or 3 days later. I didn't make a statement, but I cried. Because I thought we were much farther along.
Yeah.
And it was very painful. It really hurt. But then I kept thinking about in 1961 during the Freedom Ride in a little town called Rock Hills, South Carolina. That was my seatmate was a young white gentleman. We attempted to get off of this Greyhound bus and in a so-called white waiting room. We were attacked by members of the Klan. This is May 1961. But in February 13, one member of the Klan, who was in his 70s, former member, and his son in his 40s, came to my office on Capitol Hill. And man identified himself and said, Congressman Lewis, I'm one of the guys that beat you. Will you accept my apology? Will you forgive me? His son started crying. He started crying. They hugged me. I hugged them back. And I started crying. And I saw this gentleman 4 other times. So that's why I said, Fred, we should give up on anyone.
I'd like you to tell the crowd here about the meeting with George Wallace.
Yeah.
as he was literally on his hospital bed.
Well, Governor Wallace, I don't have to tell you his story, his history, but he wanted to see me, and I said yes. We met with him and asked him why did he order the troopers to stop us on the bridge. He said there were people on the other side to kill you. And I sort of said, Governor, do you attempt to kill people to keep other people from killing them? He didn't have an answer. But he went on to say, I don't hate anyone. He said, I love everybody. And we hugged. And I don't know what else I can say about it, Fred.
Actually, leading right out of this was one of the other questions. How has your understanding or interpretation of the philosophy of nonviolence changed over the years? Or has it?
Hasn't changed. My belief in the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence is in keeping with the teaching of Jesus. We give Gandhi and others the credit. The love is it's the heart of it. We're going to love everybody. So you can beat me, you can arrest me, and throw me in jail. But I'm going to still love you. It's redemptive.
When this was,
it free you. It liberates you.
When someone was clubbing you at that moment, did you really feel that way?
Well, in the midst, when I was being beaten on the bridge of Selma, I thought I was going to die. I thought I saw death. But God Almighty kept me here. And later that same day, I was taken to a little hospital called the Good Samaritan Hospital, where a group of nuns took care of us. And years later, many years later, last October, I was in Rochester, New York with our friend, our classmate.
Amel Holden.
Louise.
Louise Slaughter. Yep.
And she took me to the mother house. And three other nuns retired there. Retired from Selma, Alabama. They're up there in age. They're living at the mother house in Rochester. And they saw me and I saw them. We all cried together. And they kept St. John. They kept with my face and patting me on the face. But these women, these sisters, have saved us. So you can't forget that.
Here's a question. You both came into Congress in 1986. During your times in Congress, what were your best and worst experience?
I'll let John go first.
Well, just one, to get to know people. Our classmate, Amo Holton, became a wonderful friend. Almost like a big brother. Anywhere, chair, faith and politics. I traveled to his district, upstate New York. He came south over and over again. To Montgomery, to Selma, to Birmingham. And since he's retired, I'm going to see him and visit with him. I think the worst time 9/11. It was just, I don't know what was happening to the country, but to the planet.
You know, I really wouldn't disagree with either one of those. It's the friends. I mean, I have some very close friends on both sides of the aisle. I've been to their districts, Republican and Democrat, both. Get to know who they are, their spouses, their sometimes their kids, and the issues that really drive them to do what they do. And, you know, I was thinking about bad events. I mean, you never like to go through an impeachment. You never, you know, people stepping down for ethical reasons. It's just so tragic to see that happen to an individual. You know, they've erred big time. They would say that they do need to, they've lost the competence of their districts, they do need to leave. But it's just so sad to see, and again, that's just on the personal side, but yeah, 9/11, boy, we all remember every minute of that day. And for me, I was a subcommittee chair, so I went up to New York, actually, the next week. They were still expecting to find some people. Got on, literally, on the grounds of the World Trade Center, and you know, talked to the just so tired first responders, and they're just, you know, combing through, and, you know, the thick dust everywhere, and then it was at the Pentagon the next day, literally, that's still on fire. I mean, that was just an incredible, incredible day that just was so sad.
Let me just toss one in. To me, when I saw members of Congress, House and Senate, both sides gather on Capitol steps, I saw on television, singing God Bless America, I thought, well, maybe something good can come out of this horrific action, this horrific event. And then over the next year or so, the fight breaks out. Should we invade Iraq, yes or no? And that seemed to sort of break open the wounds, the healing that had started to take place. If someone said to you, if 9/11 can't bring us together, what can? And that's such a pessimistic view. But what's the answer?
It is pretty pessimistic. That event has cost us as a nation, you know, thousands of lives. I see their names on the, they have their names in the Rayburn Building. I know some of them went to their funerals. And it cost us trillions of dollars, trillions. And I've been there. John, you've been there, I would bet, too. Have you been to Iraq? I've been to both Iraq and Afghanistan. Yeah. And it's a tough place. And you don't, you know, there is no good ending. No easy solution. President Obama wanted to end it. He added troops. President Trump said the same thing. I mean, it's the longest war we've ever had now.
I couldn't bring myself to vote for war, and I voted against. And more I think about it, I feel convinced I'm more than ever before it's the right thing to do.
I've got a moral quandary here. Fred is my friend, but there are two ugly questions here. And so that no one can say that I'm trimming. Oh, good.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
Okay, I've got an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other.
Yeah.
Let me get these out of the way. The first one, I'll put these both together. Are there Republicans in the House and Senate who are striving for universal health care as the top priority in federal health care policy? And then the second one is, sir, is there a Republican congressman or senator who supports stronger gun legislation? I have been unable to learn of one. Why not? It can't be all campaign contributions from the NRA, or is it? At least they added thank you.
I'm glad to answer both of those. First of all, I am part of a group called Problem Solvers. It has exactly the same number of Republicans as Democrats. We have regular meetings. I've been on board. There's another group that's sort of similar that's sort of part of this called No Labels. I'm part of both. And the day that the Senate voted not to move forward, we met the next morning at 8 o'clock in the morning. It's pretty hard to get members there at 8 o'clock on a getaway day. And we came up with a number of principles together to try and secure the individual insurance market. Remember, I'm on the health committee. The plan that Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray unveiled last week is almost exactly what we did last July in terms of the principles. And from my perspective, and I don't, I want to fix the issues here. I cared a lot about the states that expanded on Medicaid. I care a lot about those with pre-existing illnesses. And I had some tete-a-tetes with the administration on both of those issues. And at the end of the day, actually, my language, I prevailed to get those things done. But at the end, of course, we didn't see anything. The Senate didn't do anything to get it done. But, you know, this plan that got unveiled last week is, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, we're going to have to figure something out, because the decision not to continue the subsidies, what's called the cost-sharing recovery money, is one that's not going away. We are going to have to deal with this, and it will only happen in a bipartisan way. So you've got to give us a little time, but I think in the next couple months, before the end of the year, we'll have some resolve on it that will be bipartisan, and I will be a part of it. So will John. On guns, I got into a lot of trouble back home. I had police protection for a while back when I voted for the crime bill, 94. It included a provision on background checks. Got to have them. And not for me. I don't get a lot of money from the NRA, I think. We actually looked at, someone did a little study, and it was like, I get like a couple $100 a year. That's like, you know, I raise millions, so it's like very small, but you know, I supported the background check because I believe that, you know, it doesn't violate the Second Amendment, and Michigan has a pretty good system. We ought to invest in that and make it as secure as we can. I was one of the very first, actually, I didn't know this till afterwards, I had a relative that was in Las Vegas 3 weeks ago. You know, I came out right away against the bump stock. I never heard of it before. There's no place for that. And so I joined a bipartisan letter telling the ATF, please regulate this. You can just do it without us. And I'm a co-sponsor of bipartisan legislation offered by my friend Carlos Cabello to do the same thing. It's got to go. I don't think that violates my, you know, I support the Second Amendment, but I don't think that in any way violates the stand that I have. And to me, is pretty reasonable. Now, what happens, we'll see. But I'm ready to vote to ban that thing, just as I was to say that folks on the terrorist watch list, I don't care who you are, shouldn't have access to being able to buy a firearm. And if they shouldn't be on the terrorist list, then take them off. There ought to be a due process to get it done. So I think that there's a place where we can have the right balance. And knowing that our police officers, and I know we have a couple here tonight, their lives are on the line, and you know, their families every single day. I mean, this going into work today, you know, listening again to some of those reports, we got to protect our officers because they protect us.
I'm going to pair together two questions that are a little bit more philosophical. The first one is the fault in our system or in ourselves? The second one was, how do you think about the prospect for reasonable, well-intentioned, talented people to want to get involved in national politics? Are you hopeful or despairing?
Well, I'm very hopeful. Really, I see so many young people, smart, gifted. What I would like to see, and I believe it's going to happen, we're going to see more women in politics. More of the young people today that are leaving our colleges and universities, they're so smart, they would be the leaders in this country. They would be the leaders of the 21st century. And they would help get us there. They're not tied down with some of the myths and the old ways of doing things.
Two things. Look at the crowd tonight. Second, you know, I visit a school almost every week, all levels, elementary, middle, high school, college. I'm very encouraged in my interchanges or exchanges with those students. I encourage participation, know what's going on, be engaged, be involved, know who you're voting for, man, woman, doesn't matter, regardless of party. And it is amazing when I see them again. Remember, we've both been in 31 years now. And I meet those fifth graders, but now they're teaching civics. I remember when you came to my class and I was, you know, it has an impact. And so I look at my team, and I got some former staffers that are now state legislators. Guess what? They're doing the same thing. They're doing that classroom work as well. So there is a real yearning among our millennials and others to be engaged and involved. And they want that freshness and being frank. So I'm excited about the future.
Here's a question that I'm going to throw out one thing afterward. Why does the GOP have a monopoly on church, God, Jesus, at least messaging-wise? And it reminds me of a book I read, actually I listened to it in the car, God's Politics by, he was the editor of Sojourner, Jim Wallis. And it was a book aimed actually at Democrats of don't give up on people of faith and how to talk to people of faith. Because I think in a lot of cases, a lot of Democrats have, or I should probably say white Democrats, it's almost become more secular, and they don't feel comfortable talking to people of faith. And I thought this was a remarkable book that anyone on either side really ought to read. But the part of it, point of it was that neither side has an exclusive right to talking to people of faith and talking about the Bible and politics. But I'll ask Congressman Lewis, why do some Democrats have a hard time embracing faith? And I know I'm not talking about you. But
well, I think some people, individuals in my party, they want to keep faith in their religion somewhat separate from the political arena. And this is not true in the African-American community at all, because we learn everything in the church. People go to church to be inspired. They go to Sunday school to be inspired. Most of the civil rights effort came out of the church. And I think other Dems should take a lesson from the African American community. And maybe we would be doing much better.
And on the Republican side, Fred?
Well, you know, for me, so our district is very diverse, which is a strength. It really is. I mean, so many different ways. So I've been a lot to the African American churches, particularly Baptist churches, MLK. Man, I go to those services and they go for days, it seems. I mean, it's like there's always an NFL playoff game, and I'm not going to know who's going to win that game till the next day, Sunday night. But neither side should, nor do they, I think, claim to have that Christian or religious message. I know that, you know, in the church here, the church I go at home in Michigan, I'm at the coffee hour. I'm, you know, doing a lot of different things, and I'm hearing it on both sides. You know, now anti-Trump, whatever it might be. I think there's plenty of voices on both political sides in our churches, whether they be here, and I, you know, visit with other churches back home in Michigan. I don't think anybody should or does have that single political persuasion. Maybe some of our colleagues are afraid to go there, and perhaps, and I've not read the book, though I know the author, but I think in reality it's not true.
Keeping with the faith theme for a second, Congressman Lewis, did you ever lose faith during the civil rights movement?
I never, ever lost faith during the civil rights movement. But a movement imbues us with this sense of hope that we can do it. We will survive. We will bring about change. And if it hadn't been for the music of the church, that we really live by. If you've been arrested and going to jail and someone is beating you, you just start singing one of the songs, one of the hymns of the church that lifted you. And some of the most powerful messages came out of the energy of the civil rights movement. So it was almost inseparable. Almost all of the meetings, 99% of the meetings, were held in somebody's church. And we would pray, say a prayer. There's a great picture of Ambassador Young, who's also a minister, standing with a hand up, praying, with all of us on our knees. And when the prayer was over, 600 of us stood up in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion and walked in twos across that bridge. That's the power of the church. That's the power of the Spirit.
Well, that brings us to what should we pray for in this political climate?
Pray for our country. Pray for the Constitution. Pray for each other. We have to save the country, save the Constitution, and save ourselves.
Here's an interesting question. The U.S. is seen as a Christian small c nation. Do either of you have any concern that some of the immigrants to the United States may believe that their religion does not admit any other religion to be free to practice instead of their version of religion?
I don't have any fears. I've visited refugee camps. Last week I met with a number of my DACA kids, students, and I know some of their horror stories of escape from a place that all of us would want to leave if we had the opportunity. Look at those. I met with a small businessman who's got a Syrian refugee, and he's Muslim. This other guy is like Christian Reform, and it's like, we didn't think we were going to get along too well. It's probably a mistake that I had a pig at the barbecue at the picnic in August. Not doing that again. But this guy's like, he showed us the pictures of where he left. And, you know, his brothers, and he's like the hardest working guy here. And we love him. We'll do anything to help this guy. And so, you know, we're a nation of plenty of religions. We can get along together. There's nothing that we need to fear. We got the Constitution. We have the laws of the land. But there's, you know, freedom of religion is a big part of that. And none of us should be worried about the exercise of someone else's religion, period.
This one is related to that. Congressman Lewis, how is Sharia law compatible with the Christian doctrine? And how is the Christian doctrine compatible with Sharia law?
Well, I'm not going to question people of faith, people of religion. I agree with my friend Fred. We should live and let live.
we all should survive together. Freedom of religion. I'm not going to tell someone else what to believe and not to believe, how to live.
There isn't a congressman who doesn't extol the virtues of bipartisanship.
I can name you some that don't get it. On both sides.
But successes like the Cures Act are the exception, not the rule in Congress. Why isn't true bipartisanship more like regular order? Right now, it's all lip service, I would add, for some people.
Well, that's the charge that you often hear. But in reality, at least, so my committee, Energy and Commerce, I was the chairman. First thing that I did was, when I became chairman, and, we changed the rules. It's not, whoever was the longest elected person becomes chairman. We actually compete on our side every 2 years. I changed the rules. I said, bipartisan amendments are coming first, ahead of the queue. So to my Republicans over here, he's sitting in the middle. My Republicans over here, better start talking to these guys over here, and vice versa. And when, I'll use two names, Peter Welch, who's a really decent liberal from Vermont, not quite as left as Bernie, but not too far. And a Dave McKinley, pretty conservative Republican from West Virginia. When they can get together on some climate and energy conservation, guess what? It passes by voice, and it becomes law. So for me, we had over 200 bills President Obama signed. He's a Democrat, I'm a Republican. He didn't veto them. And every one of those bills we passed either by voice or large margins. And because of a large margin, we got it through the Senate, and we got it done. So that's really most of the things that we do happen. Now, the press likes to get hung up on some real heavy-duty partisan stuff, which is unfortunate. But just, we got, and the press also likes the folks on the hard right and the hard left to be at the table yelling at each other on the, 6 o'clock news. That isn't most of us. I love John Lewis. I'm over on the Democratic side a lot of times talking to colleagues.
I love you too, Fred.
And I'm co-sponsored Democratic bills. I vote for their amendments. It's a little bit of a bad rap, but the sad thing is that some of those folks take over, and it really does become ugly, and it's not something that neither one of us participates in.
Charlie, if you would visit my office, my congressional office, there's a picture with the late Senator Edward Dirks, who was a Republican leader. When we came to Washington on August 28, 1963, black and white religious leaders and civil rights leaders, Eugene Carson Blake, great Presbyterian minister, was one of the leaders of the lodge, white. We met with both Democratic leadership and Republican leadership of the House and of the Senate. When we first came, I think we were much more, as a group, bipartisan. We renewed the Voting Rights Act.
Yep, I voted for that.
Right, only two or three people, maybe five or six people voted out of the entire Congress. And I think it renewed on the Senate side without one opposition, not a single person opposed it. We worked to get the African American Museum built on the mall.
For that, yep.
And it took me 15 years, but we had a great guy in Brownback. From Kansas, a Republican. So Republicans and Democrats came together and did some good things.
But so now, Voting Rights Act is expired. It's got to be extended. I'm a co-sponsor.
Right.
To extend it, but we can't get it out of that committee.
Out of the committee.
But I've been a co-sponsor the last 3 years.
Well, we have 1 minute left, so let me put two questions together. What is the role of confession and repentance in politics? But here's the... How does your faith affect your approach to fundraising? Or, we have 1 minute left, so why don't I go there? I've got... You don't want to go there.
No, I don't want to go there.
Okay.
Sort of is what it is,
yeah.
Sad to say.
The last one is a tough one for Fred.
Oh, no.
You haven't had any tough ones.
Oh, yeah.
I know. When is your niece, Kate, going to marry Justin Verlander?
Yeah. Well, he's got to win the World Series first, and then once that happens, then it's then they'll be married.
Well, it has been my honor to stand between two giants and two people that I admire enormously, and I think I speak for everyone here. This has been a wonderful evening that I don't think any of us will forget. And Larry, the boss, or who?
I'm Casey, the real boss. Thank you. Just kidding. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. What a gift this has been to share this sacred space, to be together in a way that we don't often see or get to celebrate is holy ground. So let us close in prayer. Holy and gracious God, we give you thanks for this evening, for all of those who have gathered in this place to remember who we are and whose we are and why we do the things we do and the purpose that is before us. We give you thanks for the gift of these three men, for Charlie Cook's moderation, for the spirit that he brought to this evening, for Representative Fred Upton, for the gifts that he brings to this community and to our country, for the humility with which he serves, for Representative Lewis, for the gifts that he has given his whole life to the betterment of this country and the world, for the sacrifice and for the hope, for the conscience in the U.S. House of Representatives. And so we pray on this evening that we would be ones who walk in this world with humility and with conscience, that we would be the headlights and not the taillights, and that our hands and feet would be the hands and feet that do the work of God, that we would bring the kingdom even closer. Amen.